You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam Nisiam Nisiaya, and the Skakulia to lead in Homasqueam Mustail. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Dog Ear Radio Book Club. I'm your host, Randy. Dog Ear Radio Book Club is a radio show book club that meets every 2 weeks to talk about a new book. I always invite a special guest on my show, and we talk about a book that they have chosen or we've chosen together and have a great conversation. You can always reach me at email at dogearedbookclubradio@gmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram at Dog Ear Radio Book Club to get more updates about the show and new episodes. On this episode today, I am joined by a guest from far, far away across the pond, as some would say. And we are talking about the book, The Soldier Scoundrel by Kat Sebastian. But I want to start off by introducing my guest today. Chels, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, so I discovered Chels on Book Talk, as some would call it, on TikTok. And you are a vintage romance collector and one of the hosts of Reformed Rakes, which we'll talk about later because it is one of my top podcasts now. And so the question I wanted to ask you is, how did you get into being a romance book collector and then talking about them on the internet?
So I love the artwork on romance novels. I think I got really into Laura Kinsale's books, and so she's a historical romance author, and a lot of her books are 90s, so like some of them have like Step Back, some of them have like Fabio covers, and my partner bought me a gift of one of her books, and I was so palpably disappointed when it wasn't the Fabio cover. It was just like, it was like a reprint that had just like people far in the distance. And I was like, oh, this hurts my soul. This makes me sad. And that's kind of when I realized that I had more of an interest in it. And I'm a nosy dude. I like to know things about my interests. I'm very like singular in my hobbies. So I just kind of went down 8 million rabbit holes from there.
That's really cool. Yeah, it's interesting because I found your page at the very beginning of my kind of like descent down the rabbit hole of historical romance, which started a bit like later. I started with Julia Quinn and Bridgerton. So I kind of worked my way backwards in the historical romance world. But yeah, that's super awesome. I think it's really interesting that you came to it from the cover perspective, because I feel like lots of people don't think about the covers of books, but.
Oh, I love the covers.
Yeah. I think also I've learned so much from you talking about them, like the history of the art in connection to the work, and like the roles that specifically when you talk a lot about like bodice ripper history in historical romance, I think that is so fascinating, its connection to the covers.
Yeah. So I think like clinch covers and bodice rippers kind of happened around the same time. Like early 1970s is kind of when both of those styles came into play. So a lot of the first clinch covers were actually bodice rippers. And these are books that are kind of spoken of. People say bodice ripper as a pejorative today. They use it to describe a book that like, oh, we don't really like anymore. We've moved past this. Things are so different. And I think that's kind of a boring way to look at them. I think that's very uncurious. And I think they're pretty interesting. They're pretty fun to talk about.
Yeah, definitely. I think the more I've done this show, the more I realize that I just keep coming back to historical romance because I'm like, there's so many things to talk about. And so my next thing is I wanted to hear a little bit about the behind story of Reformed Rakes.
Oh, sure. So Reformed Rakes is a historical romance podcast. It's hosted by me, my friends, Emma and Beth. And so we all know each other from TikTok. The historical romance TikTok is quite small. There aren't really that many people on it. So we all kind of know each other. So I think one day I started a group chat and we had kind of just been chatting for a while. And then I was like, you know what? I think we're so smart. Why don't we start a podcast? Because the things that we're saying are very interesting. Because I think like being on TikTok is kind of a fun thing, fun and frustrating thing, because you're on TikTok. It's easy to get, there's a low barrier to entry. Like you can get, you're noticed a lot easier. You can expand. You don't have to be like the most polished, but then also you kind of have to see a lot of people making like really obnoxious definitive statements, because your For You page just is the Wild West. And so I think that's kind of like when, we have episodes where we like defend miscommunication and romance and cheating and romance, two things that are like extremely reviled. That came from all of us being on TikTok and seeing the way that people would talk about these things and being like, you know, I think there's more to it than that. I think this is kind of a frustrating thing. So my contribution to the podcast is that I'm, I guess more of the romance history dude. I think I've had a little bit longer reading historical romance than both Emma and Beth, but Beth holds it all together. Beth is the one who we wouldn't have a podcast without Beth. Beth is the backbone of our show. When I found her on TikTok, she was very good at summarizing a book plot in a minute. Something I can never do. I can never do anything. So hard. And then Emma's a lawyer, law librarian. And so she has, but also has a really wide knowledge of art and classic movies. So she has a very interesting perspective that she brings to every. So yeah, Reformed Rakes, we're a historical romance podcast. We are we're very intense, but we're fun.
Oh, so fun. I was driving somewhere and I was listening to the cheating episode and I can't stop talking about it. I talk about it to everybody because I think that, and then also the miscommunication episode is like, I didn't realize what strong feelings I had about defending miscommunication until I got on Book Talk and everybody was just like, I hate this book because it's just miscommunication. And like, to oversimplify it as if communication isn't like the largest part of any relationship, like...
Yeah, that's kind of what's weird about being on, like, it's not just romance TikTok, it's also like romance Twitter. It's like people will make these statements that make me think, like, do you even like romance? Like, if you don't like miscommunication. I mean, like, I get what they mean. I think that they're thinking mm-hmm. of a specific book, but they don't want to just talk about the book that they don't like. So there's like this big, like, hit my mic. So there's like this big like gesture about these are the bad things. We don't want the bad things in romance. But I can, this is something that my friend Bailey says a lot too. Like, if you can just show me a romance novel and I will point out the miscommunication in it. Like there, it's impossible to do it in an interpersonal genre. Like, where do you want your conflict to come from?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would make the argument that like a lot of fiction books rely on some form of miscommunication, because again, in any relationship you have with someone, that relationship is sustained by communication. So at times that communication is not going to be perfect.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So obviously, listeners, I hope you're listening to this episode, but you should go listen to Reform Rakes after this as well. Okay, well, I think we should get into the book, because I know I have lots to say and I'm sure you do. So as I mentioned early in the episode, we are talking about The Soldier Scoundrel by Kat Sebastian. So I'm going to start off with what I usually do on the show, which is very poorly stumble through the description of the book, and then we'll just chat about how accurate it is. I always tell myself I'm going to practice these and then I never do. So it's always fun to just give it a shot. All right, so here we go. A scoundrel who lives in the shadows. Jack Turner grew up in the darkness of London slums, born into a life of crime and willing to do anything to keep his belly full and his siblings safe. Now he uses the tricks and schemes of the underworld to help those who need the kind of assistance only a scoundrel can provide. His distrust of the nobility runs deep, and his services do not extend to the gorgeous, high-born soldier who personifies everything Jack will never be. A soldier untarnished by vice. After the chaos of war, Oliver Rivington craves the safe predictability of a gentleman's life, one that doesn't include sparring with a ne'er-do-well who flouts the law at every turn. But Jack tempts Oliver like no man has before. Soon his yearning for the unapologetic criminal is only matched by Jack's pleasure in watching his genteel polish crumble every time they're together. Two men only meant for each other. All right, so the question is pretty simple. Do you think this is a good description for this book?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a very general, but I think that's kind of like back covers usually. Like, I would say that gives you kind of a good idea of what to expect. Like Oliver is very, Oliver wants this, Oliver wants a more comfortable life. Like he wants to fit in somewhere. He doesn't, he's just kind of unmoored from being at war and has like some unaddressed PTSD. And Jack, who he meets, is this like former valet slash fixer who is very comfortable with certain aspects of criminality. And so they kind of have very conflicting viewpoints, and they also are coming from like different classes. So I think the back cover is kind of like alluding to both of those conflicts.
I completely agree. I think it does a good job. It also like made me want to read it because I have this conversation a lot when we do this segment, specifically romance novels, because obviously there's only so much you can say about a romance novel on the back without just like laying the plot out. We always joke about like when you watch like a romantic comedy trailer, it basically gives you the whole plot of the movie in the trailer because like there's not like too much, like, except if there's like a side plot or something. But I think this book does a great job, exactly what you're saying. Like it points out the conflicts that they're going to have. It points out like the dynamic of the relationship. But obviously when you read the book, there's so much more. Like there's these two subplots, you have all these side characters that add so much to the story. And I think that, yeah, it's really good. It also is part of a series. So I think that adds to it as well. Cause I know, obviously, I didn't read the whole series. I just read this book, which you definitely can. Like, it stands by itself. But I think, yeah, like, you get these very rich characters, which I always enjoy reading. I also want to say that, so Cat Sebastian has actually been on my list to read, not like a specific book, but just to read. Because when I got into historical romance and then I got on Book Talk, a lot of people talk about her books. They're pretty popular.
Yeah.
From what I like know of. But yeah, so I kind of wanted to ask you because you gave me a list of a few books and I chose this one. So I wanted to ask you, like, have you read a lot of Kat Sebastian? How did you kind of find her work?
Yeah, so I've read almost everything. There are like maybe a handful, like small handful that I'm missing, but I've read most of her work. The Turner series, the series that this is the first book of, is my favorite. I think it's a great introduction. So if you're listening and you're curious, this is a great one to start with. Yeah, I think, when did I find Kat Sebastian? I think maybe like, early pandemic. That's, I think that was, it was a time when I didn't leave my couch very much. Like I worked from home and I would go from my work computer to the couch that was like 3 feet away and then just read. It was kind of a really fraught time, like as far as like taking care of your body and your brain and all of these sorts of things, and I checked this out from the library and just kind of kept reading more of her stuff. She does something really interesting, and I think this book is a really great example of that, because like historical romance loves class difference romance, but I think Kat has a different way of approaching it, because a lot of times when you have a class difference romance, the question is like, how do we elevate someone to the level of being an aristocrat or to being landed gentry? Like, how do we elevate you? And Kat is kind of like taking it from the opposite approach. Like maybe this isn't something that you need to aspire to be, and is able to write that in a way that's not like cloying. Like sometimes people have really cool ideas, but they write it in an eat your vegetables kind of way where you're like, that's not fun.
Yeah.
But Kat is so funny and fun. And I think that's what makes this book like so enjoyable. And even though it's like the very first book that I read of hers, I think it's still kind of one that I just love talking about.
Mm-hmm. I can definitely see that. Also, I love that you brought up the class, because that was like the number one thing that I was like, oh, we have to talk about class in this novel. Because I obviously, like, starting with Bridgerton, it's very much like a strict regency romance, like they're all like earls, like some assortment of like they have like a very close connection to the aristocracy, mm-hmm. and they all kind of like level up, they all kind of aspire to be higher within that. And so I think this kind of book, like when, and actually this came from like finding your page, I feel like I'm just gonna brag about how much I love your book talk, so just be aware of that the whole episode. One of the first recommended books that I like found of yours that I was like really drawn to is A Bride for the Prize Fighter. I know, which actually took me way too long to read after I like found it, but it's because I had to buy from Amazon and I hate buying books from Amazon. After I read it, I was like, this is what I want. Like these kind of narratives of that time period that aren't based around like dukes, earls, like any sort of like form of like the aristocracy, like you have sort of maybe like a distant connection to it. So you're like getting a little bit of that world, but you're getting this like much more real kind of like quote unquote average humans to like read about, which I think is interesting because I kind of think of it as like maybe in contemporary, like the comparison of reading like, you know, like your average everyday person versus reading like a billionaire romance. Mm-hmm. But anyways, having said all that, like I did enjoy this book. And I think it is interesting the approach that Kat Sebastian takes to like really like looking at the you know, Oliver's life of being an earl's son. And like, what does that mean? Like, where does it actually place him in comparison to how Jack both feels that he's placed and where he's actually placed in the hierarchy of the class. So yeah, this was like a refreshing book because before this I had got like sucked into a rabbit hole of reading like earls and dukes. And so this was kind of like a nice break.
Yeah. And it can be, it can be easy to do. And it's also, like I do, you know, I love a ballroom. I love, you know, things like that. Like, don't get me wrong, but like, something that Kat Sebastian is really great at doing and that she does several times in like really big and small moments in this book is not just like illustrating like the differences in class and like in a way that feels like a little angrier, but mm-hmm. also like tying it into their characters. So Jack, for instance, Jack Turner used to be the valet of his love interest Oliver's brother-in-law. So he already mm-hmm. knew Oliver from that like relation, although Oliver like didn't really know who he was because Jack was just kind of like spying on him at one point.
Yeah.
but Jack has this big chip on his shoulder because of that position. So he's constantly commenting on like the way that people treat their servants is like how he gets an idea of their character, and that his experience from being a valet, like he's so used to like not being paid on time by like these like extremely wealthy aristocrats, like mm-hmm. and so he just like, not only does he not aspire to be an aristocrat, but he kind of loathes them. So Oliver mm-hmm. is the exception to the rule in this scenario. Like Oliver is kind of like when he starts to like warm up to him, and so, but Oliver kind of at the same point, like if he's actually going to be Jack's love interest, like he can't be that guy, like he can't really be like the coddled youngest son of an earl if this is going to continue to work in any capacity. So that's kind of what makes the class differences like pretty interesting, I think, in this particular scenario. And also, I guess too, like, you know, when you get to the end, the final conflict, are we allowed to spoiler? We are, right?
Yeah, this is a spoil full
okay
podcast.
Yeah,
radio
it's
show.
hard to talk about books without spoiling. But yeah, when you get to the final conflict where Oliver just kind of has to essentially ruin himself in order to be on Jack's level.
It was the strangest, like, romantic act I've ever read. And, like, you know, like, when you had to talk about, like, grand gestures, that's, like, the kind of the strangest grand gesture. But it was very interesting, I have to say.
I'm going to get drunk at a club and cheat at cards so that I get kicked out and I'm no longer a gentleman, but I'm doing it for you. Like, and then, so that was Oliver's, like, big romantic gesture. And then Jack, you know, very surly, very stoic. I love Jack. I adore Jack. I think that his brother, Georgie, comments, like, there's one point where Oliver's talking to Georgie and Georgie's like, is Jack going to be mad about this? And he's like, well, I think he'll only be a little irritated. And Georgie's like, that's his natural state. Like, I don't know. He's just a very kind of like surly guy. But then having those like weird revealing, there's something that I think Sebastian is also really good at doing is like humorously like undercutting that. So he has the card holder, Oliver gives him, and he touches it a lot, like, yeah, it's like a gift from Oliver.
Yeah,
or that Oliver notices like funny things that he does, like when he's writing notes, he notes that one person's dog is nice, like that's like a relevant investigative note.
Yeah, I wrote when I was like writing notes about Jack as a character, I said that he's like, he's pretty blunt. He's kind of harsh. Like, he comes across as being like very surly, but he's such a soft boy for Oliver. Like, he's so like that inner like little romantic part of him is just like so, I don't know. It comes out for Oliver, which is, I love that. I love that so much. It's adorable. I also, going back to the class part, yeah, I thought it was really interesting. And I think it's an interesting dynamic in their relationship because, as you mentioned, Jack was a valet to Oliver's brother-in-law. And so it sort of like constantly comes up against. And then also Jack has a history of using his body to pleasure men for money when he was younger, which is not something he remarks as like a terrible thing, and he's not like angry about it, but he's very distinct that he doesn't want to repeat it. So he's not interested in sort of being this like just like strict point of like entertainment and pleasure for a rich man like Oliver. And so he's very kind of aware of that position. And so it's interesting how that, and then in combination with like his past relationship and like connection to Oliver come into play, and like how he resists their relationship a lot. And I thought it was interesting that kind of almost till the end, Jack has this kind of belief, like he states that like it's all going to end because Oliver will get bored. He has a quote where he says, Oliver will found some other way to quench his boredom and fill his time. And so he really doesn't until quite literally the end, I would kind of say, really have this trust that Oliver is actually committed and actually loves him, and is not just this like rich man who's like playing. So I think it's definitely what you said about how, you know, it's not that he just like dislikes them. He loathes like this class, and like that constantly seeps into his perspective of Oliver, even when I think he doesn't want it to. Like, I don't think he actually wants to feel that way and view Oliver that way. But it sort of shows of like how, you know, your history and stuff and like that connection and the way that you're like placed in the society plays a huge role in how you view each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think, and it's funny too, like even when they're not like when he's not necessarily thinking the worst of Oliver, there are like those prickly moments. Like, so Oliver is going, they're both going to do some investigation and using Oliver's position as an aristocrat to like open doors for them. But Oliver has the idea that Jack will pretend to be his valet in order to in order for him to travel along. And then Jack is like, I'm not going to do that. I used to do that for work. I'm not going to do that for you. And then Oliver's like, oh, that's fine. I'll just bring 30 shirts and I won't need one. He has those really intense, prickly moments. And I like what you said earlier too, about kind of Jack's history. Because I think that makes their relationship together even more, like, it makes it harder for them to kind of easily come together, because this is something that Jack comments to Oliver when he's trying to upset him. But, like, all of Oliver's relationships were transactional before this period. Like, Oliver is so lonely. Oliver has only ever, like, paid for sex. Like, he's only had like brief trysts. He hasn't really had a loving relationship. And while Jack doesn't ever mention like having a former lover that was important to him, like he has his cup filled by his brother and sister that he's very close to. Whereas Oliver's kind of in this position where he's very lonely. He is very bored. He doesn't really know what to do with himself. And that's kind of what brings him to Jack. Like he's kind of sticking his nose where it doesn't really quite belong, but he has this idea of like morality that he thinks that he needs to like interfere with Jack's work because Jack is immoral and someone needs to keep an eye on him.
Yeah. He needs a guardian angel to show him the right way. All right. Well, we are out of time for an ad, so we are going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll chat more about this book.
Discover Noreen Braun's album, Songs for Trees, dedicated to the forest and the spirits within the trees. As we fight climate change, trees are the lungs of the planet and we need to help them. Her jazz and blues are blended with rock and synthesized pop elements to create a textured and ambient soundtrack to nature. Songs for Trees is a narrative, with each song guiding us through a journey through the forest. A trip, literally and metaphorically, about the interconnectedness of all things. The Vancouver Sun names it one of five albums you need to hear. Find out more at noreenbraun.com.
Over and over again, over and over again, over and over again.
On January 17th, CITR 101.9 FM presents our annual 24 Hours of Radio Art Programming, featuring innovative approaches to music and sound. It's 24 hours of spoken word, ambient, drone, field recordings, and sound walks, collage, technical support calls, voicemail fails, sound art, and noise. Listen live on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca.
Over and over again. TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
All right, and welcome back to Dog Ear Radio Book Club. I'm your host, Randy, and I'm joined today by my guest, Chels. And we are talking about the book, The Soldier Scoundrel by Kat Sebastian. Before the break, we were chatting a lot about class in this novel. So kind of like, I guess like piggybacking off that topic, because it's very related, I want to talk about queerness in this novel, because obviously this is a queer historical romance. We're reading a romance between two men. And so my first question is, does it ever, when you're reading queer romance, does it ever, especially historical, well, I mean, basically explicitly historical, does it ever kind of like trigger any stress for you? So this question kind of comes from me chatting about this with other people. And I've noticed this like trend where people get like very nervous reading historical queer romance, because obviously it's like a heightened time of like it's not safe for them, right, to be out, to be in these relationships with one another in public. So it's very like we know that it's not going to end how like a typically straight historical romance would end, where they get married, they live happily ever after, they have a bunch of little children and whatever. So the author has to be very creative to give us this like happily ever after that comes with a romance novel. So yeah, I'm curious, is that like, because I know for me, it's always in the back of my mind. It's not something that like takes away from the story, but it's always kind of there thinking like, well, how is this going to end? Because in a straight novel, I'm just like, oh, well, they'll get married, like obviously. But in this, I'm like, well, they can't get married. Like, what are they going to do? So I'm curious where, like, how you kind of think about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So for queer historical romance, I think like maybe about, I want to say like maybe about like a decade or so ago, I think you got a lot more stories that were where there was like more of a heightened danger. I'm thinking of like False Colors by Alex Beecroft, which was like nominated for a Rita at the time. That one is very fraught, very stressful. It's not as common now. I think like a lot of there's always kind of like the threat of it. Like they'll talk about like the pillory or the need to be like surreptitious. Like there's that does come up, like the need to exist in isolation, like have this like love that's not for public consumption. But what I love about it so much is that I think there's this idea that people have that like people from marginalized communities did not and could not have a happily ever after before like 1980, like that this was not a life that people ever lived, ever did live, could ever navigate safely, could never navigate to their own satisfaction. And that's not historically accurate. Like there's a lot of there's a lot of records of queer people from history. And then also what's kind of interesting too is that progress isn't linear. So some of like the more dangerous moments for being queer and visibly queer maybe weren't necessarily like Regency. Like there are other times, other places. And then too, you kind of get into class too. I think like, I think it's kind of alluded to in The Soldier Scoundrel, but like for Oliver, the consequences of being outed as gay are not going to be the same for Jack. So there's kind of like all of these other different layers to it. The thing about it being a romance novel is that you do get that guarantee of a happily ever after, where you know that the main couple is going to end up together. And so what makes queer historicals so exciting is that you can kind of see what this would look like for other people. Like, and I think that's something that like gay people deal with now, is like sometimes a relationship for us doesn't look like how straight people think it would, like doesn't necessarily end the way that they think it would. So it kind of like opens a lot of doors and makes it really interesting. You do get kind of like, if you are worried, there, if it is like genre romance, it doesn't, nobody's going to die. Nobody's going to, the main characters won't, at least. So your main love interests are safe, but, yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think that there's this question of like historical accuracy that people bring up all the time. And that's usually by folks who know less about history, where they want to say that like, oh, it's not. Yeah. And they're like, oh, this isn't historically accurate because blah. Like, you hear historical authors talking about this all the time. Like somebody will be mad that they used like a curse word that they think is not historically accurate, but it actually goes back to like 1609 or whatever. But yeah, the same thing. People use that against queer people. People use it against people of color, like the idea that, like, you know, and I mean, I guess you think about it, like Beverly Jenkins writes Black historical romances, and a lot of her historical romances are set like sometimes during the Civil War, sometimes directly after, where there is that element of danger. Kind of similar to, or even heightened, like much heightened, much more heightened, but like, because her love stories can exist in that space. It can give space to acknowledging like the challenges, the differences, but it also like creates like a warm space of where these characters can experience and be acknowledged as people worthy of love.
All of that, I agree. yeah, I think the same way. And I love that you brought up the historical accuracy argument, because another thing that I didn't think I had strong, I mean, I didn't think I had strong opinions on a lot of things about books until I got on TikTok, which I think is a similar feeling for a lot of people. but yeah, like there's so many accounts. Like I was just thinking the other day, I saw a TikTok on this, like they had these houses. This was in the States, I believe, probably in California, but I'm not really sure. And this would have been like probably like mid or like later 20th century. But they had these houses that were built like right next to each other, and they had these passageways like through the basement. And so like queer people would marry like whatever, like two couples, and then they live in these houses, and like they could go back and forth to like actually be with the people. And then obviously I didn't like fact check any of that, so whatever, you can take it however you want. But I think like things like that, and then also like the whole funny thing about how like no one believed that gay women existed until like whenever, like it was just like they didn't even have laws on it, because like men couldn't conceptualize that like two women would love each other. So you just have like all of this evidence of like gay women throughout history writing like beautiful erotic poetry for each other, and like just being like, they were just friends, like they were just really really close friends, like they just lived together.
Yeah, exactly.
And so yeah, I think it's so true, and I think it also is. It goes back to that argument that I feel very strongly about, that like a lot of queer stories that we get in media are sad. Like this obsession that Hollywood has with like the historical queer tragic story. And I think that this is like a beautiful spin on that, because it like it wasn't all tragedy. Like, yes, there was a lot, but there was also love. There was also a lot of like happiness to be found. And so I think, yeah, to argue that like it's not historical accuracy unless someone dies or they're caught or they go to jail is very sad, that you think that that's what happened to every single queer person in history.
Yeah, there's and so many of this we don't, and even and you can talk about it Regency too, but like even going like closer to home, I was researching someone recently who, like, I don't want to like speculate on their sexuality, but like they were a confirmed, like by name, but like they were a confirmed bachelor in a way that I'm like, oh, that, I think they were queer. Like that's just like the signals to me made sense. And it's not something that you would necessarily like always have like out for you spelled out in a way where like it's like on the record, like I have a boyfriend and I'm gay. Like, it was most of the time people's private lives were their private lives. And they, so that's kind of where, like, queer people were a little bit better at recognizing the signals, like, oh, you're a confirmed bachelor. You did this, you said this. These are all kind of like tiny little clues. But I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, it's, and that's like, you know, 60s, 70s, very recent history.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we're just not quite used to having it spoon fed to us, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting how that's even like stuck around, this belief that you have to like prove your queerness is something that I personally, as someone in their like mid-20s, deal with a lot, that like you must like meet all of these like lists. So, like, for example, I was at a concert recently, and it's an all women rock band, and I think one or two of the members have like recently come out as bi or queer. And I overheard this conversation between these two people basically arguing that, well, I only think one of them is actually queer because the other one is just so straight. Like, she just seems so straight. There's no way that she could be queer. And that is like, it bothered me so much that these strangers would just like speculate to that extent about this person's life that you really don't know anything about, right? Like, you see images on social media, like you see their videos on TikTok, and you speculate that you know this person, but in reality, you've never met them, you've never had a conversation with them. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting how like a lot of the same views have stuck around, but have really like changed in different ways.
Yeah, like there's no really one way where queerness looks. Like, it looks different on everybody. It's and also there's not really a community. There's a community, but there's not a community. There are like sub communities, like and that's kind of what the question of representation gets so funny too, because like when people talk about like, so for example, like Rachel Reed's hockey series, like she writes like mm-hmm. a gay hockey romance, and I don't recognize any people who behave like that. I've never had queer friends who behave like that, but that's like also not my community. Like, I don't. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not friends with athletes and like and rich people, and like it's completely unrecognizable to me. So if I were to come out and be like, well, I don't know anyone who acts like that, and I'm like, well, you don't know a lot of people, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Have you met every single gay man on planet Earth?
I'm trying.
Yeah, I think that this is obviously kind of off course now, but I have Kindle Unlimited, and I will read anything. That's like, I'm here for entertainment sometimes. And that's like something I'm really fascinated in, because I have recently read a lot of gay male romance written by women. And this is me speculating, straight women. Obviously, that's a speculation. And I think that is something that's so interesting, because talking to different people have very different views on that, and like varying views of like, you know, why do women write so much romance about gay men? And then it's like, well, women write the majority of romance novels. And I think it's not necessary, because I agree with you, it's not inherently bad. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are some very, very bad ones, and there are some ones that you can really tell that there's a lot of prejudice in it. And I really enjoyed the people who speak to that from that perspective, specifically gay men on Book Talk, who will talk about that, of like things that they get wrong, things that, you know, just are kind of bad and like don't give a good view of gay male relationships. But I think a lot of them it's very fascinating, because so hockey is one, but another one is like gay construction workers or gay Mechanics is a big one. And so sort of like imagining this world where like this entire mechanic shop in this small town in the southern states is just full of gay men, and all of the men who work there are queer, and they go to this like queer bar in like this small town where their bartender is queer, and then all the construction, like it's a very kind of interesting kind of imagination and like perspective and like view of a world building. And I think that that's something that you just don't get when you read straight romances. So I think, yeah, I don't know where I was going with this. I feel like I kind of went off track, but I just wanted to remark that, like, I agree with you. Like, yeah, like you have not met every single person. So to make the grand statement that like, this doesn't fit anybody, I think is very dismissive. But obviously I'm always here for critiques.
Yeah. And I like that you brought up the construction thing, because it reminded me. So Vincent Virga wrote like Gay Wick in 1980. So it was like billed as the first gay gothic romance by Avon. I think maybe that like genre fiction, gay gothic romance. I think there are a lot of gay gothic romances. but it's set in this like Long Island estate, and like everybody in Gay Wick is gay, like every single person, every servant, every friend, it's kind of like this like isolated world. And since it's a gothic, it's like terrifying. It's but you kind of have like this this isolation. And I think like it's kind of like a lot of queer people, like before I had the Reformed Rakes podcast, I don't think I had straight friends. Beth and Emma are straight, so I love them. But like it's kind of a thing too. Like when you're queer, like you kind of, you're just like a lot of times you're surrounded by other queer people because you kind of you seek out those communities. Or so while it's kind of like a funny exaggeration to have like every position ever to be inhabited by a queer person, I do think it's more of a reflection on queer people's life than like the stories where like you ever like see those movies where there's like one gay person and you're like, he's not hanging out with all those straight people.
Yeah.
All the time. Yeah. Surely there are other, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I have seen that. I will say that like that's something that's endlessly fascinating, because as like a closeted lesbian in high school, I definitely hung out with straight people. And then when I got into university, I still was like super drawn, because I think I had this like small town comfort of like, this is the people, like I must be this person. So like you're kind of like hanging out with these people that you like kind of like embody. So in high school, I'm actually really drawn to those narratives, because to me, it like, it makes sense that it's like, you're in this town, like you're gonna just like take what you got. But yeah, I definitely agree. Like, I think university is, and college is like an opportunity for a lot of those people who did grow up in like smaller communities to branch out and like create those new communities. So yeah, it's, to me, it's like really like based on the character's age, I'm like, this makes sense or this really doesn't make any sense.
In high school, you can't really opt out. You don't have anywhere else to go. And the people you're in proximity with are going to be your closest friends. And sometimes it lasts. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. That is true. I can attest to that. And it's really funny because I have a friend who he's not a big reader, but I will send him all these like very funny queer romances that I read. And because they all have like very funny names, like they're all like innuendo names, which is endlessly funny. So I'll just like send him these. And he's like, I need to start reading these. And I was like, you really do. Like, I was like, this is like the height of my enjoyment, is just like reading a town where a bunch of gay mechanics go to a gay bar with gay construction workers. Like, I want to live in this town. And
everything will get fixed all the time.
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me? Gay people they're on it. Like, they just get things done, you know? Yeah, but going back to this historical romance novel, the kind of like last thing I wanted to chat about is the exploration of justice in this book. I think in connection of what we talked about with like queerness, class, like one of the themes that I drew is justice. So obviously Oliver and Jack have pretty different views on justice at the beginning of the book. Jack really doesn't have any use for this like law of the aristocracy and the upper class, whereas Oliver has just come back from a chaos, lawless land of the war and is really searching for this, like, you know, here's the laws, this is right and wrong, and wants that, like, comfort, as you said at the beginning. And so they kind of, like, butt heads about this from the very beginning. And I think it's interesting because we sort of, Jack stays pretty similar, like, he's had this form of justice, and he really is kind of walking Oliver through that, and Oliver's view changes as like the book progresses, and it sort of, you see it change through his exposure to people's stories and their struggles that the law doesn't care about, that the law doesn't have space for. And this is mostly specifically women. So we have Jack talking about his mother's murder and how, like, nobody cared about her life, so nobody cared to find her murderer and, like, prosecute them. And then we have Charlotte Montbray, who is Oliver's sister, who is abused by her husband, and Jack takes care of him to begin with. And then Miss Sutherland eventually murders him to protect her friend Charlotte. And then we have Mrs. Lewis and Mrs. Raxall, who are part of like a different subplot. And so, yeah, I think that is like, it was so interesting to me to read. And this is a little bit of a tangent, but I'm obsessed with this YouTube video series on Copaganda. And in the last episode, they talked about Veronica Mars. I'm not sure if you've seen Veronica Mars.
Oh, I've seen Veronica Mars.
Yeah, I figured I was safe bringing this up. And so one of the things they talked about when they did their episode on Veronica Mars is this different form of justice. And I kind of drew parallels between that episode and this book because Jack is sort of a private detective, not really. He's like this fixer, but he investigates things, gets to the bottom, and like helps people. And he's very specific about the people he helps, namely women and women who don't have access to the support of this like aristocracy law that would protect them. And so, I think it just has this like really beautiful exploration of justice and kind of like, you know, laws are not there to protect everybody. The laws were written for the aristocracy to protect the aristocracy. And I really liked Oliver's kind of path through that, through discovering that and then coming to terms with understanding that. But yeah, enough about what I thought. I'm very curious how you kind of thought about that.
Yeah, I love your thoughts on that. I completely agree. I think Oliver, I think like maybe the first time I read that, I think I kind of missed the sadness of Oliver, which like every time I come back to it, it's something that strikes me more each time. Because when you read it, it can be very easy to be like, Oliver is ignorant. Like Oliver doesn't understand that he... Oliver is ignorant. Oliver is a hypocrite. Like he doesn't understand that laws for him are different from other people. And he also doesn't understand that his very love life is breaking the law. Like he law and order is not, is fallible. Like it's something that he cannot thoroughly rely on. So it's kind of easy to hone in on that. But I think kind of like thinking about his time in the Peninsular War and when he was just injured at Badajoz. So he kind of remarks that he saw a lot of atrocities there. And atrocities is kind of a vague word for what he described. It was basically like his soldiers like harming people like outside of like the traditional warfare. Although there's not, that's kind of another thing. I think you mentioned this too, like warfare is basically, there's no really traditional, it's just like bloodthirsty and there's like no real laws or governing or and so he's kind of like really yearning for like some sort of rigidity, but he's also very lonely. And so that's kind of where he finds Jack, is because Charlotte hired him. And he's like, what are you doing with Charlotte? He cannot fathom. He doesn't know Charlotte well enough to know that the danger that she is in from her marriage. Like he has this remove from her. And so that's kind of another eye-opening moment for him is when he finds out that Jack was essentially protecting Charlotte's life by doing these like criminal things that Oliver is like frowning on and like shaking his fist at. There are quite a lot of moments. I think Miss Sutherland is kind of the final bow on everything. Yeah. So Jack, murder is too far for Jack. Like, Jack's not going to murder. He's not. And it's something that when Oliver is like insulting him, he implies that Jack murdered Lord Mowbray. And so this is a step too far for Jack. It's a step too far for Oliver. But when he finds out that Miss Sutherland killed him to protect Charlotte, and I think it's implied that Miss Sutherland and Charlotte are lovers. That's kind of what 100%. I got from it. Oh, 100%. Yeah. So I think that he kind of recalibrates that too, because like this like in theory this was something that was like unconscionable to him, but like in practice, what is he going to do? What does justice look like to him? Does justice look like having Miss Sutherland hanged? Like that's what are your alternatives? So I think this is kind of like something that he needs to extrapolate, like what justice looks like in practice, because a lot of the times it's just more people getting hurt, more people getting injured. And then Lord Mowbray, he needed to die. Honestly, there was no way Charlotte 100%. Could have comfortably lived. Like getting him out of the picture. And I think it's so funny, too, that they're just like, oh, yeah, Jack just hired someone to conk him on the head and take him away for 2 years. And I'm like, that sounds like a very, like, cartoonish, like a weekend cartoon way to get rid of someone. But, like, in practice, it's got to be, like, a very violent act. Like, essentially put into a press gang or something like that. That sounds horrifying. And Lord Mowbray just returns and he's just... I mean, he's not an on-page character, so you don't know how he reacts to that. But I think that's quite funny that there's no him just being like, what happened?
What did you do? he is very like he's placed as like a clear-cut villain, which I think works well for the story. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I really like the exploration of justice. Because it was very funny that I was like, I'm not going to read another book about the military with a military character or a cop. And then I literally chose this book. And then, in a past episode, we were also talking about, it's called it's by Jeannie Lynn. I think you just talked about it on your show.
The Jade Temptress. You talked about Sanjana, didn't you?
Yeah.
She's great.
Yeah. It's great. So it was so funny that I was like, in the first episode of the season, I was like, no cops and no military. And then here I am. But I'll always make exceptions for historical, because I think it's a completely different perspective than reading contemporary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can get just because I think a lot of times, and this is something that my podcast co-host Emma kind of talks about a lot with like Bow Street Runners and Newgate, like a lot of our, and you get a lot of American historical romance writers writing about like law, justice, police and crime in Regency England from what they know of the American modern justice system, but it worked very differently in ways that are horrifying and also better. Like it just kind of depends. Yeah. It kind of complicates it a little bit. It's a little bit of a, it's not quite a one-to-one, so you can you can wiggle around a little bit more.
Which is like the fun part. That's what I want. That's what I like to do. So but yeah, we have drawn to the end of our episode. So thank you so much for coming on the show and chatting about this book. So excited to have you on.
Thank you so much. It was so much fun.
Yeah. And do you just want to share with the listeners of where they can find more of you?
Sure. So my name is Chels. I do have a TikTok. The username is Chels_ebooks. I'm also the writer of the romance substack, The Loose Cravat. That's theloosecravat.substack.com. And finally, and probably most importantly, I am one third of the historical romance podcast, Reformed Rakes. You can listen to that wherever you get your podcasts.
Amazing. Well, yeah, once again, thanks so much for being on the show. Thanks for listening to Dog Ear Radio Book Club. Enjoy the rest of your night, and we'll catch you next time.